In 1949, the Nestle company launched a new product that would become world famous, Nescafe Instant Coffee. Now, the product's advantage at that time was very clear. You could have coffee that would dissolve in less than 3 minutes in hot water. And this was a radical new invention. Actually, their pre-testing on people showed that people liked it. But they also found it interesting that when they rolled it out as a product, their sales were disappointing. So Nestle began to research and asked people, why don't you buy instant coffee? And they quickly found out they were dealing with the problem. And the problem was perception. It was a problem of perception. One of the things they did was to conduct an experiment, a focus group, with two groups of housewives. Each group was given a shopping list, and each shopping list was identical, except for one detail. One shopping list had Nescafe instant coffee, and the other shopping list had regular grind coffee. And they asked each group to describe the type of woman who had written the shopping list. And what they found out was that the group whose list contained Nescafe, they described that woman as lazy, unorganized, and a bad wife and mother. So they found out what the real problem was, why consumers weren't buying Nescafe, was a perception. As they pursued this further, that women had that if they reduced the time they spent in this labor of preparing a good pot of coffee every morning for their husband and family, that their families might consider them to be lazy. And so what the company had seen and developed as something they saw as a great advantage was perceived by consumers as a great disadvantage. So what were they to do? Well, Nestle went about, they still had to target women because women were the primary buyers. So they launched an advertising campaign based on the slogan that this is the instant coffee that will allow you to dedicate time for more important things. This will allow you to dedicate time for more important things. They had to point out the product's advantages without going against a woman's need to be perceived as a dedicated housewife. And it worked. It worked. But like so much of advertising, they weren't selling a product as much as they were selling an illusion of what the product can do for the consumer. The ad campaigns capitalized on that, and one of their ads, for instance, referred to relatives living far away, and it was aimed to work on producing a guilt trip. And basically its focus was, it's been a long time since you've written them a single letter. But now, with Nescafe, you can save time, and with the time you save, you can do some of the important things in life. And through clever advertising, they started changing the perceptions, and Nescafe took off, and today we don't even think about it. It was a great strategy. And that's basically one of the things that makes successful advertising campaigns brilliant, is that they target perceptions and they play to the perception. It happens to us all the time. And so Nescafe is now accepted worldwide. There is a core principle in advertising and marketing, and it's the idea that perception is reality. Perception is reality. Advertising people study to find out what the perceptions are, and then they go to work on those perceptions in the marketplace because they know that people, that their reality is whatever they perceive it to be. And so we have this core idea that perception is reality. It's not just in advertising. It's become a catchphrase that people use. I've said that before, perception is reality. I've heard it used. But when you stop and really think about it, you have to ask a question about that premise. Perception is reality. And the question is that reality? Is that statement true? Is that reality? Perception is reality. Is that reality? Is that right? Is that true? In the Nescafe example, the survey revealed that the perceptions were real. People really did have perceptions. But were those perceptions reality? Were the housewives really lazy? Were they in truth bad wives and mothers if they were to buy instant coffee? The perception is real, but was the perception true? Was that true? It's a question that we're going to think about today because the answer can be a matter of life and death. Is that overstating? Is that overstating it? Not a bit. We're going to cover a subject today. If you like titles, the title is Perception, Reality, and the Days of Unleavened Bread. Now, by raising the question in your mind, let me establish right off the bat that I don't want to minimize perception. Are perceptions powerful? Oh, absolutely. We have to deal with them all the time. They can have a powerful impact on life. Does perception count? You better believe it. It sure does. We have to deal with our own perceptions, and we have to deal with the perceptions of others. Can perceptions influence us? Absolutely. They can alter our thinking and behavior. Can perceptions be destructive? Can they hold us back from growth spiritually? Absolutely. If they are wrong, they can hold us back. You know, there's a statement, a lie can run around the block before the truth can get its pants on. And if a perception is a lie, if it's not accurate, but it's passed on to other people like it is accurate, it can be very damaging. We can consider a few things both logically and biblically about factors involving perception. What about perceptions of others? Let's face it, we all form them. We all form perceptions of others, and sometimes very quickly. How many of you, if I can just get a show of hands, how many of you are aware that you have ever at some time in your life had an initial perception of somebody only to find it later on proven wrong? Oh yeah, there go the hands. And it can be in a number of ways. You might have met somebody that your impression, your perception of them was, man, they are stuck up, they are snobby, they're aloof. Then later you find out, no, they're just very shy and they're not socially comfortable. And so they come across that way. But that's not really what they are. Let me ask a show of hands, how many of you at one time or another been misperceived by somebody? Oh yeah, that happens too. You've been misjudged. We all can do this. Three people can look at the same person and have three different perceptions. Are they all reality? Can they all be reality? If they differ, they may all be wrong. There are perceptions about people. There are perceptions about situations. We could point to a number of examples, but I'd like to take you to 2 Kings chapter 6. In 2 Kings 6, here's a story of a perception that someone had. They did not have a full understanding, and so they perceived things to be in a certain way. In 2 Kings chapter 6, we'll break into the story, but it's Elisha and his servant. 2 Kings 6 and verse 15, the servant of the man of God rose early and went out, and there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And he answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And the servant probably said, "Okay, I'm with you. You're with me. And there's a whole bunch more of them." But Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Open his eyes that he may see." Now later on in the sermon, we're going to see that we need to pray a similar prayer about ourselves, that God will open my eyes that I may see some things from God. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. But he was blind to certain things. He could not see them, and so therefore he had a very different perception of the situation than Elisha did. Let's go back to 1 Kings. Elisha's mentor, Elijah, went through an interesting situation. Elijah had stared down the prophets of Baal, had stood up in faith, and then killed 450 of these false prophets by the sword in an amazing, miraculous thing. Ahab, the king, trotted back to the palace, told his wife Jezebel. Jezebel says, before sunsets tomorrow night, I'm going to have your head. And Elisha, who had just come out of killing 450 prophets of Baal, heard this. She must have been some woman. He, it says, ran for his life. In 1 Kings 19:3, when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life. And he ran into the wilderness. He came down to a broom tree exhausted, and he prayed that he would die. And he said, Lord, it's enough. Take my life. I've been through enough. Just take my life. Pleaded with God. Lord said, if you read through here, Elijah, what are you doing? In verse 10, he said, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts. The children of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've torn down your altars and killed your prophets. And I'm the only one left, and now they're after me. That was how he was perceiving things. And to him, that was reality. So God said, I want you to go out here. And he sent an earthquake. Or first of all, it was a great wind. And the wind was so strong, it tore at the mountains, it said, and broke the rocks in pieces. But notice verse 11, the Lord was not in the wind. And the same thing happened after an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake, and after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire, verse 12. And after the fire, a still, small voice. Now, winds that rip up mountains and earthquakes and fires, that impresses people. But that's not where God was, it says. God was in a still, small voice. There's a lesson in this. Sometimes we look to powerful things to impress us. God doesn't always work that way. Sometimes he wants us to listen to a still, small voice. And in verse 13, he asked him again at the end of the verse, what are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here? And so Elijah, just like verse 10, he repeats the tape, puts it on rewind, plays it again. I've been very zealous for the Lord God. The children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets. I alone am left. They seek to take my life. He was fixated on an explanation that he had been thinking about. That's the only way he could see the issue. And to him, that was the truth of the matter. But it was far from the whole story. And so the Lord said to him, look, go your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria, anoint Jehu the son of Nimshi as king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah as you shall anoint as a prophet in your place. And it shall be whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. One more thing, Elijah. Just one more thing. I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Reality is, Elijah, the reality is, the truth of the matter is, you're not alone. There are 7,000 others who've taken a stand. You're not alone the way that you think you are. But Elijah, working off his own perception, chose a course of action that God very gently steered him back away from. He despaired. He ran. He just wanted to die. And God said, no, Elijah, you're not thinking correctly. James says Elijah was a man with nature like ours, and he formed perceptions, and they were a reality to him. They were a reality to him, but those perceptions led him to go the wrong way, and God had to redirect his thinking. In Deuteronomy 29, we find an interesting statement. Deuteronomy 29, in reviewing the history of Israel, their wandering in the wilderness, Moses made a statement that contains a very important principle. Deuteronomy 29, verse 2. Now Moses called all Israel and said to them, "You have seen all that the Eternal did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh, to all his servants, to all his land, the great trials which your eyes have seen, the signs, and those great wonders. Yet the Eternal has not given you a heart to perceive." Now, does this mean they were without perceptions? Oh, no, they had perceptions. They had been perceiving all sorts of things. They perceived that God led them out into the wilderness to die. Then that was proven wrong. They perceived that Moses had fallen off the face of the earth somewhere. He disappeared, so I guess we've got to turn and make some idols. They'll save us. That perception was wrong. They perceived that there were giants in the land, and who were they to go into the promised land? And by the way, let's get rid of these troublemakers, Joshua and Caleb. They were ready to stone them. Their wrong perceptions led them to terrible actions. But God says, or Moses said, "The Lord has not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and to hear to this very day." There was something about the heart that was lacking. They had a heart. They formed their own perceptions, and sometimes it didn't take much for a mob mentality to get everybody wrapped up en masse in the same perception. Perceptions are easily influenced. They could be wrong. The Lord had not given them a heart to perceive. Remember this, because we're going to come back to this later, but here's the lesson. Their perception was not reality. The truth was reality. The truth was reality, and God is the revealer of truth. There can be perceptions of others. There can be perceptions of situations. There can be perceptions of self. Paul wrote in the book of Philippians, we won't turn there, but you can read, Paul described that at one time he had a perception of himself. He said, "I am righteous, I am blameless, I am zealous for God." And that was the way he saw himself. And it all came crashing down because it was all wrong. Here's an example Christ gave in Luke chapter 18. We will turn to this one, Luke 18. And the story of the Pharisee and the publican is a story entirely of perceptions that people adopted, the way they saw themselves. One had an accurate perception and one had a very inaccurate perception. In Luke 18, in verse 9, he spoke this parable based on the perception that some people had. It says, he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. See, it started with the perception. The despising of others was a bad thing, but that began with a perception that I am righteous, they're not, therefore I'll look down on them and despise them. And so Jesus saw this, and he said in this parable, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Love the way this is worded in verse 11. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. That's as far as it went. It was talking to himself, but it was in the form of a prayer. Oh God, I thank you. I'm not like other men. That's a perception. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, even as this tax collector. You notice who he was picking out. You know, there's a lot of picking and choosing as to which men he would compare himself to. You know, pick the worst of that you can find. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess. And that's where he was. He trusted in himself that he was righteous. Now the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Now, he had a perception too, but in this case, his perception was accurate. And it led to an entirely different attitude. And then the lesson, Jesus says, I tell you, This man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be abased, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. There are reality checks that are needed in life, and he was trying to get that through to a group of people. But when you think about it, exalting oneself or humbling oneself is largely a matter of perception, either a right perception or a wrong perception. Now, this is a good illustration. There are two other remarkable sections in the Bible that we need to consider when we talk about humans having perceptions that are found to not be reality, and how these are life and death matters spiritually. One of these sections is 42 chapters long. It's a detailed story of an individual culminating in a profound lesson, and it's preserved for us as a mirror for every person to look into. The second example is only 8 verses long, but it's no less important because it's written for the people of God specifically. But both of them hit very, very much right to the heart of perceptions that are held very strongly but missing reality. This long 42 chapter story is actually about several people who were trying to explain and figure out a situation. And most of the book is given to their discourses that they were giving on their perceptions. They all saw the same situation. They were all looking at exactly the same situation, but they all were coming at it from different angles. They all had their own perception of it and their explanation of it. And they held firmly to their perception as reality. Job's perception of himself was not reality, but he gave a strong defense of himself that in his mind was absolute reality. We won't go through the whole book, obviously, but in chapter 31, let's just get a peek into Job's thinking. Job was trying to figure out what was happening to him. The situation was what had happened to him. Then he had his friends who were, they had their own perceptions of why this was happening. In chapter 31, in verse 1, Job said, "I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? For what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways? He said, man, I'm trying hard. I'm trying to do the right thing. I have even made a covenant with my eyes. I wouldn't even look upon a young woman." And here's somebody who's really fighting hard, you might say. "Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? If I have walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance, that God may know my integrity." Job was righteous. I mean, he was a righteous man. And he did try hard. But he did not see the complete picture of life, his own life. In chapter 32, finally reached a point where everybody just shut up. Almost everybody. Chapter 32 and verse 1, "So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes." There's another person that had not yet been on the scene named Elihu. "Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. Also against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer, yet had condemned Job. Now, because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was aroused. So Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, said, answered and said, 'I am young in years, and you are very old. Therefore I was afraid and dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age should speak, and the multitude of years should teach wisdom.'" And that is true. Age should speak. The multitude of years should teach wisdom. But the aged can also lack proper perception. Then he notes in verse 8, very important, but there is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. Therefore I say, listen to me, I will also declare my opinion. Indeed, I waited for your words, I listened to your reasonings, while you searched out what to say. I paid close attention to you, and surely not one of you convinced Job or answered his words. So this was a very difficult circumstance. Verse 13, lest you say, we have found wisdom, God will vanquish him, but not man. Now he has not directed his words against me, so I will not answer him in your words. So he goes on, and Elihu begins to speak. We come to chapter 32, and in verse 12, he says, chapter 33, in verse 12, he says to Job, look, in this you are not righteous. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend with him? For he does not give an accounting for of any of his words. Verse 14, for God may speak in one way or in another, yet man does not perceive it. When God speaks, what he says is truth, but humans don't always perceive it. We can be blind to what God sees. God is the one to confirm what is true, and he does. And later, God addresses Job. In chapter 38, we find four chapters of a discourse that now is God talking. God loved Job. God loved Job. He wasn't going to let him go, but he also had to understand that he had to crush some of Job's self-perceptions because it was playing right into Satan's hands. Job's perception of both himself and God was not reality, and it was leading him to some terrible judgment. So in chapter 38, verse 1, the Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel? The wrong perception can make things muddier. By words without knowledge. Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. And this was the beginning of a way to approach Job that would change his outlook toward God. In chapter 40 and verse 1, chapter 40 and verse 1, moreover the Eternal said, answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. That's a great way to have the conversation handed back to you, isn't it? God says, okay, Job, it's now your turn to speak. You've been correcting me. What do you have to say? Job answered the Eternal, and it's very clear that he was coming to a point where his perception was changing and reality was beginning to set in. And Job answered and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer twice, and I will proceed no further. And so God takes up the conversation again. Chapter 42, the perception has changed immensely. Chapter 42, verse 1, Job answered the Eternal and said, I know that you can do everything, that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. That was the greatest thing that could happen to Job. His perception aligned with God's, finally. And he repented. So it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Eternal said to Eliphaz the Temanite, My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. You'll notice he did not include Elihu in this, because Elihu was on the mark. This is a great example of a quote that I read one time. It says, reality is what smacks you in the face when your perception is off. Reality is what smacks you in the face when your perception is off. Now, brethren, let's ask the question. How important was it for Job to see reality instead of living by his perceptions? I think we would all say it was a matter of life and death. It was a matter of life and death for Job. Now, the other account, which is shorter but no less important, is found in a prophecy for the church. It's found in a prophecy for the church in Revelation chapter 3. It is also an issue of perspective. In Revelation 3, verse 14, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, these things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. He says, I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were cold or hot. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth. Now, what was the issue? Because, he says, it's because you say, when they had reached a conclusion, they had taken a position in life, and it was based on these perceptions. The perception is, I'm rich, and have become wealthy, and have need of nothing. That was a perception, a spiritual perception. Reality, he said, you do not know that you're wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. That was the reality, perception versus reality. Now, they had a pretty strong perception. He goes on to say, what do we do then? He says, I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see. Well, they already saw something, they just didn't see it right. So he said, the application here is, get this from me so you can see things my way. It's like Elisha. I said earlier, remember that? Elisha said, Lord, open his eyes that he can see. There's a prayer that we should pray often. Open my eyes that I can see. I need to see. And not just see things from my perception, but to make sure it's from God. We cannot afford to live by wrong perceptions that are not reality. This is the ultimate. This is the ultimate fatal result of falling back on false perception that is not based on God's Spirit at work, but rather what Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart, the human heart, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. But then it says, who can know it? Well, God can know it, and God's people can know it through God's Spirit. That's how we know it. We can know it. The mind of God, the Spirit of God, helps us see the truth and break through perceptions. Rather, the fact is, sometimes we toss out sayings. Somebody says it, somebody else repeats it, we hear it, pretty soon everybody's saying it, you know, perception's reality. When actually, perception is reality only to the person who's perceiving it. It's reality to that person. And that person may think it's real, but that doesn't make it so. Perception is perception. It may be right, it may be wrong. But it's very important to know that we make decisions based on our perceptions. We make judgments based on our perceptions. We take actions based on our perceptions. And so those perceptions, we need to really make sure they're true, that they're right. The idea that perception is reality is in itself a perception. And it's also a presumption. It can only be confirmed by the truth. So, since this is the way of life for all of us, how do we deal with it? What do we look for? Well, God's Word is very clear. God's Word is very clear. The only accurate, righteous measurements of the reality of circumstances or other people or ourselves is truth. Truth. Truth is reality, not perception. Truth is reality, not perception. And truth is of prime importance to God. Let's go to John chapter 4. If you were to look up the word perceive in the Bible, here is a place you would come to, and it's a very good story. It's a very good account of two different people with different perceptions, one of them being partially correct, but still needing some things filled in. John 4:19, the story of the Samaritan woman that Jesus addressed at the well. There was quite a discourse they'd had about living water. And in verse 19, the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." And she perceived accurately. There were others that he was around, been around, they'd known him, and they never could perceive that correctly. But she got it. She said, "I perceive you're a prophet." Then she went on to say, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth." Spirit and truth. It's not enough to say, "I'm a good-hearted person and I have great intentions and have a right attitude." There must be truth that goes with it. "For the Father is seeking such to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth." It's fundamental to something that is of importance to God. We often say that John was the apostle of love. He's often called that in books and commentaries because he speaks about love so often. And that may be true. It is true. But God also encouraged John to speak about truth a lot. Truth is also a dominant theme in his writings. Can't help but wonder if maybe that's because truth and love are inextricably tied together. Truth and love are tied together. John uses the word truth 27 times in his gospel here. 27 times. Then you go to the three short books that he wrote later. And in 1 John, he talks about truth 10 times. And the two books that follow are only one chapter long each. But in 2 John, he uses the word truth 5 times. And in 3 John, he uses the word truth 6 times. 48 times in his writings, John talks about truth, truth, truth. You get the idea that it's really important. Now, a little bit later, John has an account in chapter 8. You'll turn there, John 8. Here Jesus originally was having a discussion with the Samaritan woman. And that discussion went far better than this one he was about to have. And so in John 8 and verse 30, Jesus said, he spoke these words, as he spoke them, many believed in him. And then Jesus said to those Jews who believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed. and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Perceptions will not free us. In many cases, perceptions offer nothing but slavery and bondage. Wrong perceptions keep us in denial. Wrong perceptions keep us in a wrong frame of mind. Wrong perceptions make us judge wrongly. They perpetuate spiritual blindness. So he says this, and it goes right over their heads. They were so prejudiced by their strong perceptions, they could not see what he was saying. And furthermore, it distorted their ability to even reason with him. They could not even have a logical conversation. And it's almost comical what they said next. In verse 33, they answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" You know, in some ways, you just wonder if Christ just sort of shook his head and laughed. I mean, this is a ridiculous perception. Several times in their history, they had gone into captivity, and while they were speaking, they were under Roman captivity. Roman dominance, I should say. Roman occupation. But their emotions, whatever it was, clouded their perception. Now, Christ wasn't really concerned about who was occupying the country. He was really talking about spiritual bondage to sin. That was his big concern. But if they could not perceive that they had never been in captivity, how could you expect them to perceive spiritual things? Well, that's where they were. Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin." Their clinging to their perceptions, their defending themselves in God's sight, kept them from seeing the truth, and therefore they stayed a slave to sin. That's where they were stuck. Now, in the very next chapter, we have a remarkable story about a man who is healed of his blindness. And coming off of this encounter in chapter 8, you almost have no doubt that Jesus used this situation, this opportunity, to further the point that he was making about perceptions blinding people. Sometimes we talk about teachable moments. This was a teachable moment. What a great time. And the healing of the eyes of this blind man, the physical healing of his eyes, was not only, it was physically great for him, but it was spiritually symbolic for everyone of what is required spiritually. So to cut through to the story, the young man is healed. This comes to the attention of the Pharisees. They haul him in. They haul his parents in. They're just trying to get them to say, this man did not do this. But they're all saying, well, what can we say? He did it. And so in verse 30, this young man is hauled before them, and he answered and said to them, "You know, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from, and yet he's opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind." Now think about that, brethren. Think about that spiritually. Has anyone opened the eyes of somebody who is spiritually blind since the world began? Only God can do that. Only God can do that. But physically is what he was talking about. He said, this can't be. In verse 33, he said, "If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered, and again, it's great to see, it's funny to see how human nature works. They answered and said to him, "You were born, completely born in sins, and you're going to teach us?" And you think, what does that have to do with the argument? But it was a carnal reaction. Who are you? Who are you to teach us? So they cast him out. Here's the poor guy. He's healed. He's rejoicing. Everybody's rejoicing. And this big brouhaha comes over, and he's caught up in the midst of it. He's just having a really good day, and they were ruining it. Well, what happens here, Jesus heard that they'd cast him out. He went looking for him. He said, when he found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" And he answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." Then he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." Basically, he was saying, people who don't see, I can give them sight, perception, understanding. Those who claim they see will remain blind. Some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also? You calling us blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see,' therefore your sin remains." Sin remains when people do not see things through the eyes of God. This blind man could perceive accurately, but the Pharisees clung to their perceptions and they were not reality. And they could not come out of sin. Remember what we read in Deuteronomy 29? The Lord has not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and hear to this very day. And the ramifications of that statement are now explained in John's Gospel in chapter 16. We read this on the Passover. John 16, verse 13. He was speaking about the helper, the comforter coming. John 16, 13, Jesus makes the statement, "However, when the Spirit of truth has come, it will guide you into all truth." Will guide you into all truth. Truth is very elusive. Truth is unattainable to humans left to themselves. We stumble on parts of it now and then. We find a bit of truth here and a bit of truth there, but without God working in a human, no human can put all the pieces together. No human can put all the pieces together, not only about doctrine, but about ourselves and about our spiritual state. Without God, we fall back on our own perceptions, and every human has them. And they may be reality to us, but they're not the truth. To be what we must be as God's people, we must be on a quest for truth. We must be on a quest for truth, and that's made possible by the working of God's Spirit. Now, the title of the sermon was Perception, Reality, and the Days of Unleavened Bread. I'm sure you've connected the dots to the Days of Unleavened Bread, but let's make sure they're tied together. The Passover, leading up to the Passover, the Days of Unleavened Bread, that time of the year is designed to help us stop and have a reality check and to seek truth. As David described it in Psalm 51:6, "Behold, you desire truth in the inward parts." And in the hidden parts, the things that are hidden from us, the things that we don't see right, David said, "In the hidden part, you will make me know wisdom." God will help us. God will help us to see things. He will give us the right perceptions, the right understanding. It will come in time. How did Paul describe the focus of the Days of Unleavened Bread? We already were there briefly. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. What is the focus of the Days of Unleavened Bread spiritually? In 1 Corinthians 5, in verse 6, Paul said, "Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump?" What was he speaking to? He was writing this in the context of a serious problem they were having in the church with the way that they perceived a situation going on in their midst. They perceived that they should just tolerate this fornication. And they had not only reached a wrong judgment, but in their perceptions. They had not mourned the way that God would have had them, but they had become puffed up, he said. They had become puffed up. In verse 2, he said, you're puffed up rather than, and have not rather mourned. They were taking this in the opposite direction of what they should, because they had it all figured out, you might say, as to what was up. And they really, it was very important to them to see the truth. They had to see the truth. And so Paul writes in verse 7, therefore, purge out the old leaven. What was the leaven? What was the leavening for the whole group? Was it that person who was sinning? No, it was the way they were glorying. It was the way they'd started thinking about it and the way they started behaving and the judgments. And he said that was the old leaven that was leavening the whole lump. Purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. We lead up to the days of unleavened bread, and by the time that sundown came last night, the old leaven was to be put out. That represented sin. But now during these days of unleavened bread, we do eat unleavened bread. These are not the days of putting out leavening. These are not the days of putting out leavening. That should have been done before the day started. These are the days of eating unleavened bread, of focusing on sincerity and truth, being like Christ, seeking his mind, pursuing that. This is a feast of stripping away perceptions. This is a feast where it doesn't matter what perceptions we have. If it's wrong, it needs to be gone. This is a feast of seeking truth, of going to God and saying, I need to know truth. Now, should this go on throughout the whole year? Of course it should. But this is a time of the year, the days of unleavened bread, that helps us really come to grips with this vital principle. We all have our perceptions. We have them all the time. We have to really be on guard to make sure that they align absolutely correctly with God's perception, that they align with the truth, because these are the days of truth, seeking truth. If you saw the sermon on the Sabbath over there in Kennewick, I asked you at one point, how would you tell the story about how God called you? I bet if we actually did that and had people come up and tell us the story, it wouldn't be long before somebody would use an in-house phrase that is very common. How often do we say, well, God called me into the truth? It's a common statement. It's an accurate statement. It's a true statement. He did. But it's good to understand that when he called us into the truth, he called us into the truth on two tracks, if you will. Two areas of truth. Number one, he called us to understand the truth about doctrine so we could believe the right things. But number two, he also called us to understand the truth about ourselves so that we could be the right people. He called us to understand the truth about doctrine so we could believe the right things, and then he called us to understand the truth about ourselves so we could be the right people. And in fact, the doctrinal truth is designed to help us come to understanding of self, not perception. Not perception. And once we have that understanding of self, that's what allows us to start conforming to the image of Christ. That's what allows us to begin working to strive to conform to his character. Having doctrinal truth is insufficient. It has to be combined with having self-truth, self-understanding, and then godly character begins to be built. Godly character begins with the desire to see oneself in truth, not in perception. And then it's coupled with a willingness to conform one's thinking and behavior to God's will, to be transformed by the renewing of your mind, Paul said in Romans 12. It's change that begins with the transformation of the mind, coming to understand truth. It's the quest for character. That quest says, I can't lean on my own understanding. As Proverbs points out, we can't lean on our own understanding, but it seeks the truth about ourselves. And in the revealing of that truth lies freedom. There's where freedom is. Freedom to understand sin and to come out of it. The freedom to throw off wrong perceptions, wrong habits that keep us in bondage. That's how the truth makes us free. But brethren, we live in a world that just works on perception. It thrives on perception. It values perception. I have the right to think what I want to think. Of course we do. But as Christians, we have the responsibility to think the way God thinks, to seek the truth. It is found in the world in issues big and small. So whether it's an advertising campaign for Nescafe coffee, or whether it's fundamental, philosophical, and moral decision-making, we're living in a world that has all sorts of perceptions. It's a world that's picking off the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and it's stuffing itself more on evil. But it's all based on the way humans see it, as opposed to the way God sees it. We have been called to come out of this world and to be on a quest for godly character, to be seeking His knowledge, to be seeking His understanding, His truth, not only about doctrine, but about ourselves, so that we can be the people that He wants us to be. Because in the end, only truth is reality. Only truth is reality.